Hi everybody, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. Will you please join me in the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Okay, with respect to our speaker, please silence your cell phones. And our speaker is being recorded with his permission. CDs can be purchased from Darren over here. And I would like to introduce this evening's speaker, Steve from Oceanside.
My name is Steve Wolf. I'm an alcoholic. First off, my sobriety date is December 20th, 2000. My home group is the Leucadia Men's Stag on Tuesday night, as well as the Beverly Hills Roxbury Men's Stag on Wednesday night up in Beverly Hills. If you haven't been there and you're a guy, sorry, women can't come to that meeting. It's a good meeting. Check it out. I have a sponsor. I sponsor men in this program. I want to thank Mike for asking me to come out here to speak tonight. And happy birthday to the people who took birthdays and the two new people that stood up. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. It's interesting life these days after doing this program for a while how life changes and the things that you see. I could have never imagined when I walked into this program at 16 years old that I was ever going to stay here, let alone stay sober for as long as I have, you know, and it really has been a one day at a time deal. I was born in West Hollywood, 1984, to date myself, and I had a pretty normal life growing up. You know, I had like two parents, and they were pretty smart people, managed to stay together. I had a pretty normal childhood growing up, just as normal as any other kid. I had an older brother, a year and a half older than I was, and we lived growing up there, and I, to tell you the truth, I don't really remember too much of my childhood. It's funny. It's kind of like when the period of time that I was drinking from like zero, from being born to like 10 years old, I don't really recollect all that much of what happened. It was kind of like when I was drinking, the same thing. I remember like bits and pieces of it, but it was all pretty good for the most part, you know. And then sometime we moved down to San Diego, and around 10, 11 years old, I remember just turning into this angry young child. And for no particular reason, except I just didn't seem to fit in anymore. You know, everyone that I hung out with and my friends, and I was doing all the normal things that 10 and 11 year old boys do, I just didn't seem to mesh with these people anymore. And I couldn't understand what was wrong for me. And I would take out this aggression, this violent young aggression on my parents, obviously the people who were closest to me at the time. And so, you know, my parents, they're good parents, being the good parents that they were, they tried to get me some help, so they got me in touch with, psychologist, psychiatrist, something of this nature, and this psychologist told me he had the solution, he figured it out. Apparently I had attention deficit disorder, and I was clinically depressed, and I was all these things at 11 years old, and I don't know anything, I'm just a kid, and my parents, they're not alcoholics, they know nothing about this program, they're about as normal as they come. And so they were just doing the best that they could to try to help me out. But this psychiatrist started prescribing me all these incredible new wonder drugs that were coming out at the time, right? This is in the late 90s. So now I really feel different, you know, because now I'm medicating myself to try to be normal again. And this is my first introduction to drugs, you know what I mean? Any kind of a controlled substance. So when I turned 12 years old, I found punk rock music. And this changed me forever, you know? And that's when I had my first drink, right? My first drug. And all of a sudden, I wasn't angry anymore, you know? And I had an outlet in where to take this aggression that I had and a sense of community and people that understood me and thought like I did. And it seemed to be such an easy, you know, jump from like the medications that, you know, the doctor was prescribing me to self-medicating myself, because the shit that I took worked and the stuff that he gave me didn't work, you know? And it was easy to make that jump. And I remember that even as a young kid, it just seemed to make sense to me. I was like, well, I'm taking drugs anyway, so I'm just going to take the drugs that I like because they work way better than what he's giving me. And so I ran with that. And that period of my life, right, that's when things actually kind of calmed down a lot. Like, it really worked for me. You know, and if you remember, like when you first started drinking or doing drugs when you're like really young, you're super paranoid, you're trying to hide this from your parents. My parents grew up in the 60s. This is no surprise to any thing that they've ever done growing up, but like, I'm scared, like I don't want them to find out. I think it's really bad. And it's just working for me. I mellow out a lot, you know, and like life at home seems to be normal, and I kind of like reacclimate, but I got into playing music and that was my outlet. So I started slipping away as like my alcoholism progressed, even at a young age. By the time I was like 1 year into it, and I was about 13 years old and started playing in my first punk rock band, and I was just getting loaded every day. Like 13, 14 years old, I was just getting loaded every day and running around the band, and my parents were just like, my dad was always like, oh, it's just a phase. He would downplay it. You know, he would always downplay anything that I did. So he was like, oh, it's just a phase. And my mom's always freaking out, like, oh, we got to do something about this. And so one night I'm at home, it's like the summer, like eighth grade going into high school. And these two big dudes show up in my bedroom and they say, and I'm freaking out because I think we're getting robbed. And they're not there to rob the house. They're there to extract me and take me to an outdoor wilderness therapy program. Outside of Provo, Utah, in the middle of nowhere. And I'm not going, right? I'm going to put up a fight. And so I'm like, I'm not going anywhere with you. And these were like two big football players. Just remember, I'm 13, so I must weigh like 105 pounds, 110 pounds, wet. And there's these two big football player looking dudes, and they're just like, look, kid, we can do this the hard way or the easy way, but you're coming with us. And I was like, all right, I'll pack a bag. So the next day, you know, I'm in the middle of Provo. They like strip search me and blindfold me and drive me out into the wilderness and drop me off with all these kids out in the middle of Utah. And they let me out, and I'm just thinking like this is weird. I don't know what this has to do with, like, you know, I don't see the correlation between my drug and alcoholism, but it was just like I was being bad and this is the way I was going to be punished or something. And so they drop me off with these kids, and it's like they're running around, they got like super long hair and they smell and everyone's all dirty. It's like Lord of the Flies. And they come up and they're like, what was the last thing that you had to eat? I was like, Burger King. I don't know. And they're like, Burger King is so good. I'm like, how fuck long you guys been out here? And they're telling me their story. One of them's like, oh, I've been out here like 6 months, 8 months. And I was just like, this is not day camp. Like we have like, we're issued a pack and like a bag of like refried, freeze-dried beans and like lentils, and they gave us like hiking boots and a 2 gallon gas tank that we put water in, and we just hiked. It like, you know, pooped in holes and just like hung out in the wilderness. And I had still, like, even being there, I had no idea what this had to do with like my drug or alcoholism, but I was learning really cool skills. It was like crash course Boy Scout camp or something like that. It didn't keep me sober, but if you send me out into the woods with a shoelace and a pocket knife, I can survive for a couple of weeks, I guess, you know? So anyway, just like any good alcoholic, I figure like if I have any chance of getting out of this program, because I don't want to stay out here 6 months and God please not a year, I'll just straighten up and fly right and tell these people what they want to hear so I can just get out of here. So I'm just like, sign me up. I'll volunteer to do anything, right? Put me in charge. Like, I'm your guy, you know? Just, like, get me through this so I can get out of here. And I get through that program pretty quickly. And about, like, 3 months later, the parents come out, and they're, you know, I had them all fooled. Like, they're sitting there with their parents, and they're like, you know, we don't understand why you sent your son out. He seems to be such a good guy. Like, he's, you know, he takes initiative, and he's the leader and everything. And my dad's like, yeah, that's my son. And my mom's just like, oh, he fooled you. You know, 3 months, $9,000 later, I'm back home in San Diego going into my freshman year, and I make it 1 week until I get in a blackout drunk at the Friday night football game, you know, the Friday night football games, and I get in a fist fight with one of the football dads in a total blackout drunk, and then the security dude comes up and I try to run, but I trip and fall and knock myself out, and I wake up in the principal's office and he's asking me, he's all, you've been drinking tonight. I'm like, well, I had one, but just one. And he's like, well, it doesn't look like you had one. He's like, I'm going to go call the police. And I threw up in his trash can and he came back. And then I ended up getting alcohol poisoning and awoke in the hospital the next morning. I was about 14 years old now, to like that look on my parents' face that I got really used to. seeing. You know, like I failed again. This was only a week after the program. So they send me across the district to another high school because apparently the unified school districts think that if you just take the bad kid out of school and move him across the district with no help, that he'll just start hanging out with all the really smart, good kids and turn his life around. And that, maybe some people have that experience, but that wasn't my experience, right? I found a bunch more people just like me, and now I was like networked because I knew people from like all over both neighborhoods. I could play this game really good now. And so I'm playing my music, and I got like my little band going, and that's actually the only thing that's really sort of working for me at the time. That's kind of keeping me on somewhat of like a straight and narrow. And so about 15 and a half years old, I get recruited in this band, and we get a little record deal, and I start touring around. And these guys are all 19, 20, and I'm 15 years old. The name of the band was called Minor in Possession. And so this is all I ever aspired to be growing up. You know, I just wanted to be a rock star. So if I could like play music and not have to work, or like I could ditch out on school as much as I could and like chase like women and like drink and like do drugs, I was like, this is it. You know what I mean? It's just kind of like it all happened so quick. And by the time I was 15, 16, I didn't really have any plans to go to college or what I was going to do past 18 because like, man, it was here. I was living it, you know? So I'm loving this, but my drug and alcoholism is progressing so much, and I'm getting into harder stuff, and I'm getting into situations that we've all been in before, where you know I knew consciously like I didn't belong here with these people, you know, those places that you end up where like you look around and you're just like, this isn't what my parents wanted for me to be, you know, and they really try to have my back, but at some point it got so bad where they were just like, you know, I was about 16 years old, and they're just like, do whatever you want. You know, they're like, we can't control you anymore. You're just nuts. You know, we can't live like this anymore. You know, and as soon as you're 18, like you're out of the house. And I thought I was just like, finally, you know, like they're going to just let me be. That's all I want. Just leave me alone and let me live my life. The next 6 months were my downward spiral of what brought me into the program. And in those 6 months time, I managed to lose everything that was important to me, including getting kicked out of that band, which was just like so sad for me at the time, because that was the only thing that I loved to do that I was actually good at the time, and like all I had to do was show up and play, and I couldn't even do that, you know, and could even probably made a good career out of it, but I couldn't even do that. I failed at it, and I ended up at 16 and a half somehow with 5 felonies and 2 drug overdoses. And woke up in the hospital again for that last time, thinking the last time before I went into that, you know, drug-induced overdose, really trying to die that time, you know, really just trying to, really just like not wanting to be here, just kind of wanting to fade away and not having to deal with the reality of how bad everything became even at that age. And I woke up, and the first thought that I had, you know, in that hospital bed for the second time was like, I can't even kill myself right, you know, I can't do anything right. And I felt like I let everyone down, that everything that was important to me was gone, and I just wanted to die, and I couldn't even do that right. And so that's when I had that moment of clarity. You know, I got some legal issues at 16 and a half years old, and I'm scared because I'm going to go to jail, you know, and I have a serious drug and alcohol problem, and I was done. You know, at that point, that second time I went to the hospital, I was done. And I came to my parents and I was just like, look, I'll do anything to change. I'm done. And they didn't believe me, naturally, because everything that came out of my mouth was a lie. I found that at a young age that I got really good at lying. But the thing with lying is that you got to remember what you lied to people about. And things get foggy, and then like your stories get mixed up, and then you start getting caught, and it's just a downward spiral from there. But I was done lying, and I was just done playing the game with people. So I found an old drug and alcohol interventionist that I convinced my parents was crazy and I wasn't that bad years before, and I asked them for help. I said, listen, I'm done. I'll go anywhere. You know, if you tell me to put a tutu on and go dance around the island of Samoa and that's going to change my life for the better, then like, let's go. I'll pack my bags and go tomorrow. And he got me into a recovery house in South Los Angeles, where I lived at till I was 18 years old. And for the first time in my life, I was surrounded by some people who were my age that talked about things like not only staying sober, but doing the right thing and honor and integrity and brotherhood. And I just didn't think people like that existed, let alone young people getting sober in the program that actually stayed in it. I remember sitting in my first couple of AA meetings up in LA, and people would get up like tonight and they'd take like a cake for 5 years. And I would just sit in my seat and think to myself, like, that's impossible. Like, who's this guy fooling? Come on. You know, like, no one could stay sober for 5 years, because that was the reality of my life. You know, and I really didn't believe people. And I was just waiting for somebody to say something about, you know, Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, so I could like throw a chair across the room and be like, you fucking kooks, I've seen this before. You're trying to get me into your cult and I'm out. You know, I'm not trying to do that. But this day never came. And Alcoholics Anonymous just took me in. And I found a sponsor. The recovery house told me I showed up to my first meeting, Rockberry Men's Stag, on Wednesday night up in Beverly Hills, and the recovery house told me I needed to go get a sponsor. So I walk in there. I don't know anything. I'm 16, right? And if you all have ever been to that meeting before, you men out there, it's like, you know, there's like 200 guys in there, and they're older, you know, and like everyone's like laughing and like they're talking shit before the meeting and like having a good time, and like I'm just like scared of all these people. I'm just a kid, you know? And so they point me in the direction of this guy, my former sponsor. His name's Mike W. And I asked him to sponsor me, and he was like really serious. He's like, "Are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober?" And I was like, "Yeah, dude, I guess so." You know, he's like, "All right, well, you need to call me at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, and we're gonna get in the book this week, and you need to be at this meeting every single Wednesday." And I was like, "Okay, dude." And I walked away from that like, I'm not calling that dude at 6 o'clock in the morning. Because you, in the recovery house, you've got to get up like, you get up at 7 o'clock every morning, you got to do all these chores and everything, go to bed late. Like, you need that time in the morning. I need that time to sleep, you know? And the next morning, strangely enough, I woke up at 5:50 and I couldn't go back to sleep. So I was like, all right, well, I guess I'll call this dude. So I walk up to the payphone with my calling card and I call him and said, "Hey, Mike, it's Steve from the meeting last night." He's like, "Oh, man, I really didn't think you were going to call me." And I was like, "Really? You didn't?" He's like, "Yeah, let's see if you can do it 2 days in a row," and hangs up the phone. And it's like, this asshole. And I'm complaining to the recovery. I was like, "You know what this guy did to me? He hung up on me, right? I tried to call the dude like he told me to do. He just hung up on me and told me to call him tomorrow." So I was like, "This motherfucker, I'll call him tomorrow. Like, he's not going to win this, right?" He knew me. You know, he knew how I thought. He knew how to get me. And so I called him the next morning at the same time, and we developed a relationship. And that was the sponsor that I had for almost 10 years till he passed away 2 years ago, August. And I love that man like a father. And, you know, the next years to come, because this is me and my life getting sober when I was 16, staying sober was the only thing that I actually ever completed at that point in my life. And then it was the recovery house. That was the second thing I actually completed. Then I finished high school there, you know. Until that point, I'd never completed anything in my life, you know. And so I found that in AA, and I got sober pretty old school. And they told me that, you know, you need to go to meetings, like you need to do 90 and 90 and get a sponsor and work the steps. And he took me through the book as it's outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I worked all 12 steps, and I did it very thoroughly. And, you know, he stuck with me, and he drug me up to that meeting every single Wednesday. And I made long lasting friendships with men in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I grew up in this program. You know, I got out of the recovery house and I moved into my first little apartment in South Los Angeles when I was a week before I turned 18 years old. And I started. And I could have never have guessed, you know, getting from where I was coming from, getting through the recovery house and where I was, where my life would go over the next, you know, 5-10 years. I was just, it's all seemed new and I was excited. It was an exciting time for me in my life. I was 18 and I finally felt for the first time like I had a chance and a community of people. And so, you know, luckily my sponsor and the people that we hung out with, it was important for them that once I got a couple years sober and I got through my steps, that I sponsor people and that I go do something with my life. So they said, "You should probably go to college." So I went to college. And, you know, they said, like, well, you know, I'd call Mike up. I'd be like, "Oh, Mike, you'd be so proud. I got, like, you know, 4 commitments at all these meetings." And Mike would be like, "When do you have time to work?" I was like, "No, man, I'm doing like AA." He's like, "Kid, go like quit 2 of those commitments and go get a fucking job, you know?" He's like, "That's what you're supposed to do." He said, "This you got to understand Alcoholics Anonymous, the way that I was taught was that AA is not supposed to consume my life, right? AA is supposed to get me to a point where I can then have a life. And these are the things that they taught me, and I see that all too many times, right? That, you know, we in Alcoholics Anonymous, we let this consume our lives. But it was important for them. They said, Steve, you're a young kid, and you're an example of this program, and so you need to go out now and do something with your life. You know, unlike a lot of people that got in here, since you got a chance and to be so blessed to get this at a young age, right? Now you can actually do something with your life. And if you don't do that, if you don't move forward and you don't do that, then you're pissing all over everything that everyone who came before you tried to teach you. And not just in AA, but we're talking about like your parents and everybody who sacrificed, made sacrifices for you. And so I did it. You know, I started my first business when I was 18, and the craziest thing started happening. Like I went out there in the world and I put myself out there and I tried to do it. And all of a sudden, like all these people, totally unsolicited, just kept helping me. You know what I mean? They're like, oh, you need it. I was like, man, I don't know how to do tax. Like, oh, so-and-so's a CPA. And I was like, yeah. And then they would like call me and be like, hey, so-and-so told me that, like, you know, you need help with this. And the dude just helped me. I didn't even ask for it. And they got me to the next step. You know, so I went back into college and I started a career. And then it's like the next 10 years of my life. It's like at this point, I hear speakers when they get up and like, we tell funny stories, right? Because this is what we relate to. We identify with the things that we did when we were, you know, getting loaded, when we were still out there. We all identify with that. I like to spend a lot of time talking about the years I've been sober and all the incredible things that's happened to me as a result of being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and working a program, you know, and taking that message to the next person. Because that's it. You know, I couldn't even begin to, in 40 minutes time, tell you the absolutely incredible experiences that I've had as a result of being sober in AA. There's just so many, you know, and I couldn't even in 40 minutes like highlight the best of it. That's how much good stuff that there is, you know. And then there's also bad stuff too, because that's what happens to us when you get sober. You don't get immune to bad things happening to you. You know? And so I got young and like I wanted some things and I failed at some things, but I learned how to stay consistent. That was a trait, a skill set that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I did well in that first business, and then I got into another business and I started making a lot of money when I was in my young 20s. And this kind of went to my head for a while, and there was a period there where, you know, I'd always hear the people in AA say, they're like, oh, well, I had the house and the car, and like, you know, that shit doesn't matter. And I'd be like 20 sitting in an AA meeting. I'd be like, well, I haven't had a house and the car. Like, speak for yourself, man. I want to get that shit, you know? Like, I want to have that in my life. Like, I'm sober, damn it. I'm doing something with my life. And so it was true. And it's funny how all these things come full circle. You know, the wisdom of the ages in the room is what happens when you get a bunch of people together who've shared a lot of the same experiences, and then we trade these ideas. This is what happens in an AA meeting. You know, and so I'm learning all these things, these mind-blowing things. And like I had these mentors at a young age, and I just had so many of them that, you know, they got, I just got to learn so much, you know. But there was a lot of me being socially awkward. And when I had about 21, when I was 21, I was getting about 5-6 years sober. And all the buddies that I got sober with when I was 18 were all turning about 4 and 5 years sober. And I lost a really good mentor of mine. You know, the dude who started the recovery house was a really good friend of mine. He passed away. And people kind of scattered, you know? And I felt like at that time in my life, things were going really well, but that was my first real, that was the first like person who was really close to me that I had a relationship with who just like passed away and died. And it affected me. And a lot of the dudes I got sober with, like they didn't make it, you know? And almost like 10 years later, thinking back on it now, none of them are sober anymore. None of them. I think there's one person left from that time in that recovery house that I got sober. And even during the time, I watched 100 guys go through there and not make it, you know? And so I always wonder sometimes, was what made me different, you know? And sometimes I think, well, maybe, you know, maybe it was bad enough for me. I definitely believe that, you know, like when I was done, I was done. I earned my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I used to get a little shit from the old timers. They'd be like, what, how old are you, kid? Like 14? I'll be like, no, I'm 16, or I'm 17 and a half, right? And I'd be like, well, like, what are you doing in AA? Like, I spilled more than you drank. You're just a baby. And I'm like, well, then you must have spilled a lot of beer, man. And you also, they must have not had fucking speed when you were a kid, because that shit speeds it up by like 10 years, right? You should see all the drugs that they have out there now. Shit is crazy, you know? It's a crazy world out there. And, you know, if you're a young person in AA, and you have a desire to stop drinking, that's the only thing that you need for membership, and you've earned your seat in Alcoholics Anonymous if no one's told you that before, you know? And no one can take you out of that. for whatever reason. You can't even quantify a desire. That's what I love about it. I can go on a 20-minute diatribe about how AA is anarchy, right? It's total anarchy. If you wanted to write a letter to complain, no one has the authority to even answer it back. I love that, and I love that idea because there are no leaders. It was what Tom was reading in the 24 hours a day. There is no professional class. There's just alcoholic. That's all that you get, you know? And what makes us different from a cult is that there is no centralized leader unless you're a part of the Pacific group. And I love that about AA. Because that makes us all simple. No matter what I have going on in my professional life, no matter what kind of car I drive, no matter how much money I make or I don't make, or what kind of life that I live outside of here, the best I'll ever get in here is just sober. You know? And it keeps my head right, because I remember that in my young 20s when I was making all this money and I started coming into AA, and like, it started messing with my head and things changed, you know? I would sit in meetings and I would hear people talk, and like, newcomers, and they'd be like, oh man, my girlfriend, and like, just like all the normal stuff that you hear, but it's all about perception, right? I'd sit in, when I used to hear that stuff, I'd relate to it and I'd be like, oh man, that's like, you know, tough break, you're going through some shit, it's okay, let's have a hug, you know? And like, now I was sitting in the meetings and I was just like, this shit again, you know? Like, really, this is like your problems? And I started telling myself the story. I was like, I'm not like these people. You know, I've changed. I'm not like them anymore. And those next 2 years was a very lonely time for me, because I started thinking I was different to the point where it almost got me drunk. 24, 25 years old. And I was like, I professionally, I was doing the best that I've ever done, like, in my life. And, you know, spiritually, I was like bankrupt. And it hurt because all the stuff, like the guy, and all I could hear was the dude in AA, like, I had the house and the car and everything like that. I was like, dude, I got all that shit and I'm so unhappy, you know? And I have to go back to AA and like hang out with these people because they're the only people who understand how I think, you know? They're the only people who get me. And so I could try to buy my way to happiness, or like use any kind of like vice that I could find out there that's going to allow me to escape reality, whether it's temporarily or long term, but I'm always going to come back to this because this is who I am. This is simply who I am. And so I came to terms with that, and I had a crazy couple of years. How much time do I have? 20 minutes? Great. We're gonna tell some fun stories. I came to terms with the fact that this was it. So I said, I have a decision to make. I could leave AA consciously. I'd say, like, when I'm 23 years old now, I've made my own way. Like, I've got the house and the car. I've got some money in the bank. Like, you know, I've pretty much finished college. I've done these things. And to like, the outside, normal, unassuming person, they'd say, like, I don't know why you still go to those AA classes. You seem to be, like, a pretty normal guy and you got your shit together, you know? And I would just kind of, like, 2 years ago, I'd be like, yeah, but if you only knew. And now it's just like, you know what? You're right. I do kind of have my shit together, right? And that was me taking the control back, you know? This is what happens when God slips away out of my life and I start thinking that I'm responsible for the good or the bad things that happen in my life. Which is an insane thought, because I know I'm not. And I've already agreed to that deal before. You know, I've already come to terms with that before. And so I made that decision where instead of like, you know, leaving, I was just like, man, I could just take a bag of money and go to Las Vegas and like, we'll just see what happens. And that was like really where I was at, or throw myself back into AA. And so I was down in San Diego, and I newly moved back there because I was living up in Los Angeles, and I just threw myself back into Alcoholics Anonymous again for the second time. And got back into the steps again and did it again and started sponsoring guys. And that's always the thing. You hear people say when they leave the program, it's because they stopped going to meetings. But I think it's one thing more than that, because if you have some long-term sobriety and you stop going to meetings, I don't think that that's the thing that takes you out. I really think it's tied to sponsorship, you know? Because if you're not working with new people in this program and giving back what was so freely given to me, then what I'm doing is like not only neglecting my own program, but I'm being ungrateful for the people who came before me and made those sacrifices for me to learn. And I've learned it to be a truth in my life that when I'm working with new people in the program, it's very hard for me to be a scumbag. You know, it's very hard for me to make those bad decisions because I know that I have other people that are depending on me to not fuck up. They're depending on me to be there, right? There's two great honors in Alcoholics Anonymous. One is being asked to participate in service, whether that be speaking or, you know, cleaning up the doo-doo in the butt cans, like at the meeting or any kind of service work that you can do. I think the greatest honor is sponsorship. Because that's how this works, right? It's in the book and it's in sponsorship. You can come to meetings and hide out. Someone who was taking a birthday cake tonight shared about that. You can come to meetings and hide out. You know, but the dude who reaches his hand out, the woman who reaches his hand out to the new person, Alcoholics Anonymous, that to me is the miracle. Because these are things and concepts that I didn't understand before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't reach my hand out to people. I didn't even fucking say hi to people. You know, I didn't want to know you. I didn't want you to get close to me, because if you got close to me and then I had to screw you over or hurt you, then I actually had to feel bad about it. And I didn't want to feel bad about it. I didn't want to feel at all. You know? And I remember that. You know, there was two times. That first time I woke up in the hospital, and then I remember when I was 14, the biggest difference, I had a friend, a really good friend of mine. His name was Kevin, and he was just like us two running around, and he was trying to, I don't know, join the Navy or something. He couldn't get in because he was a screw-up. He's an alcoholic, too, and he ended up, he shot himself in the head, and he killed himself. And I remember being at his funeral at 14 years old, and the only two things I felt was just like, you know, coldness and anger. And I remember everyone crying and being super sad, and I knew, I intellectually knew that I should be upset about this because this is one of my best friends, but I felt nothing inside. I knew that was the point. The only thing that I knew how to do to medicate that was to not feel more. And it's funny how, like, you know, those forms of fear and those things will manifest themselves a million different ways, with or without drugs or alcohol involved in it. And that's been me in my life over the years. You know, the first thing that we can do is we don't drink or use no matter what, and we come to a meeting. We try to pick some things up, you know, and then you put some time together, and like, then, you know, we intuitively know how to deal with situations that used to baffle us. And sometimes things still baffle me, and this is what a sponsor's for, you know? It's to help guide you and direct you to deal with that. And my sponsor, like I said, I love that guy like a father. He taught me how to tie a tie, how to put a job resume together. You know what I mean? How to show up for my own life. These were things that I learned in AA. And it doesn't say that anywhere in the big book, that a sponsor needs to do that. But that's how they helped me. That's how they took care of me. They went above and beyond. You know? And so the least I can do is give that to a new person. So, somewhere around the time when I was living in San Diego, and like I had it, you know, I got through all that, and I took a trip, and this is another really cool thing. I like to travel, and for the first time, I was like 23, and I left, and I took this trip to Europe, and I went for 2 weeks and ended up staying for 3 months, and I do everything alcoholically. And the coolest thing was, is I, you know, I got out there, and I went with a study abroad trip with like all these college kids, and everyone's just getting like, you know, I show up on the day, like we all leave, and we go to Spain, and I'm out there, and they, you know, they're being college kids, so they're drinking and having fun, and like no one believes that I'm sober. I keep telling them, like, dude, I'm like 6 years sober, and they're like, yeah, right, dude, you look like you party, like you're not sober. And I'm like, no, really, I am. And they just wouldn't believe me. That was the first time I ever dealt with that. And then I realized, I was like, man, I'm like thousands of miles away from home. I got to find a meeting. So I found a little meeting in Madrid, and that kind of was interesting, because then I sat in this meeting, you know, 6,000 miles, 8,000 miles away from home, and you know, it was really hard to find. I got lost on the subway, and I finally find this meeting and like walk into it late, and it's the same thing as here. You know what I mean? Same bad lit room in a church somewhere with some bad Spanish version of coffee, you know, and the same 12 steps on the wall in Spanish, and I never felt so at home again. You know? And it's absolutely incredible. I always make a joke about it. It's like Fight Club. You ever seen the movie Fight Club? We're fucking everywhere. You know? You can't see us and you don't know. And we have our own little code. You know what I mean? We have our own little code words. Like, you have a friend of Bill W. And you know this because if you've ever done that with somebody and they're not, they're like, Bill who? Like, what? Who's Bill? It's either, you know Bill? Like, they tell, ask their wife, you know Bill? Who's this guy talking about? And you're, oh, never mind. Different guy. But we have our own little code. You know what I mean? We have our own little secret code, and it's the only entity that I've ever been a part of, the only culture that I've ever been a part of, where no matter where I am in the world, if I find an AA meeting and I come in there and say, my name is Steven, I'm an alcoholic, right? All of a sudden I have a room full of people who understand me. More importantly, I have a room full of friends. People I can count on. I mean, this is an incredible story. I don't even think you can get that if you get the Black American Express card with the concierge service, right? You don't even get that, you know? people who care, who actually genuinely care about you. And so every country that I've traveled to consecutively after that, I've managed to find a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the experience has been the same. I've been to a lot of countries now over the years, you know, and the people are the same, and I've made incredible friendships like all over the world that I have here. And our common bond is we don't drink or use no matter what. That's our common bond. It's Alcoholics Anonymous. This is way more than I bargained for when I signed up. If you told me that that was going to be my life 5, 8, 10 years into that, I would have just been like, that's crazy. I couldn't even fathom it. You know, as young as I was, I couldn't even fathom it. I mean, I remember that was the hardest thing getting sober young, was that 6 months seemed like an eternity at that time. You know, let alone like a year. A year's sobriety. I was just like I said, I didn't believe it when people like said it. When I finally got it, I was just like, man, I guess this can be done, you know? Because I didn't believe in myself, and it took me years to get that confidence back. But I continued to do it, you know? And I came back, and sometimes I would leave AA, but AA is here, whether I show up or not. It doesn't need me to continue, you know? It will go with or without me. And so I can choose to be a part of it and give back what was given to me, or choose to leave it, but it's going to continue to go on. And like I said, it's interesting. It's like I said, the purest form of anarchy. We invade your churches and your clubhouses, you know what I mean? And we deal in all cash. And we don't even have last names. You can't find us, you know? You don't even know we exist, but we're everywhere. And it's remained that way since the dawn of its time, completely unchanged. And it's the only thing that I know that's like that. It's never been corrupted. It's never been changed. And it's because the members who are a part of it is what keep it alive. You showing up here every single day, one day at a time, being a part of it is what keeps it alive and thriving and all over the world. It's what gives us a place to go to. It's what gives us a safe haven from the outside world that makes it different. You know, and these are just some of the incredible cool things that I've learned when I think about it, because, you know, we all go there at times. You know, there'll be good days and bad days. And like, I had a couple good years, and then the last 3 years getting up into where we were now, I went through some pretty hard stuff. You know, I had about 9 years. So like they say, 10 years, like my 10th year sober was just like the worst year of my life. You know, like I was saying, I have this girlfriend that I met in AA. I wouldn't suggest. I just won't say anything on the topic. Either way, she was in AA, and like, when we were really happy, that was like one of my healthiest relationships I'd been in. After about 3 years, she decided that she was not going to be sober anymore, and I tried to stick with her, but like, she drank like I used to drink, and I never knew that side of her. And it's just absolutely interesting to see how quickly a person changes. And like, well, that was like going on. My father, you know, caught some charge and ended up going to prison, and then my sponsor, he was, you know, dealing with his fourth bout of esophageal cancer. And so for like a year of my life, and I'm here, I am in like my last year of college, and I'm involved in young people's AA. I was serving on the ACIPA committee down in San Diego, and the industry that I was in before like ended overnight, and my, you know, thousands of dollar a month income went to zero almost overnight. And that house that I bought when I was 21 was now worth like $100,000 less than I bought it for. And so here I was at 23 years old, like $140,000 in debt, and everything fell apart. My dad's going to jail, my sponsor's dying of like cancer, and all my friends, like I said before, like got drunk and like disappeared, and then my girlfriend like just checked out like emotionally, and I was just like, man, this sucks. And for like a year of my life, all I was doing was like literally going to meetings, and I would leave on Friday and go to the federal penitentiary to visit my father. And I'd kind of laugh about it, because I'd be like, it'd be sitting there on Saturday and he's in a jumpsuit. He's not like a criminal or anything. Like he was a doctor for like 37 years and just caught like a bad charge, and it ended up being cheaper for him to go to prison than to fight it. And so I'm up there visiting him, and, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm just like, you can't make this stuff up. You know, this is crazy. You know, I would spend the day with him, and I just try to make the best of the situation and be like, Dad, I know you're in prison, but, you know, it's kind of cool because I get to see you now more and hang out with you than I ever did the last 5 years. We were hanging out. And I said, don't worry about it. Like, Mom was taking care of my brother and I. We're financially in a place to do that because of, you know, being like having my shit together. So we took care of my mom, and like, my dad didn't have to worry about that. And I would, you know, leave Lompoc and come back down to through LA where I got sober, and I'd go spend, you know, Sunday with my sponsor who's like dying in the hospital. And I, again, like, you know, just to talk about him a little bit, like, I love this man. And this is when I really realized that, like, all the money and the stuff really didn't matter, because I remember just driving home every weekend thinking that, like, I'd give it all up. Like, you could have the car and the house and the money and everything like that to cure him, because I don't want him to die. I just don't want him to die. And I just don't care about all these things. They're removable. They're replaceable. And I finally got what that dude was saying, you know, the dude who was running through my head in the meeting, because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter any of that, right? When you make real relationships and you find out how to love somebody, then it really doesn't matter anymore. And I love that man. I'd have given up anything to keep him alive for one more day, but he was fighting and he was a tough guy. You know, my sponsor, Mike, I'd call him up and I'd be like, there'd be like clanking going on around the boat. He liked to fish. He had this boat in King Harbor, and I can't stand it. I can't, like, fish or golf. Just not, two things not for me. But he used to love to fish and golf, and so I'd hear like all this clanking around. I'd be like, Mike, what are you doing right now? He's like, oh, I'm pulling out this thing on the engine of my boat. And I'm like, what are you, like, dude, you just got a chemotherapy like yesterday. You know, what are you doing on the boat, like, wrenching on the engine? And he's just like, don't fucking tell me what to do, kid. I'm still your sponsor, you know. But he had this will to live. He said, Steve, look, until the day I die, I'm going to live my life to the fullest. He's like, and I'm not dead yet. So if I want to go work on my boat, I'm going to go work on my boat. And I was like, I think I slept in that morning till like 10 o'clock. And I was just like, man, I got to get my day started here. You know, like, my sponsor dying of cancer is like up doing stuff with his life. And that was the type of guy that he was. And he taught me that deal. And so from that point forward, I had this epiphany as I knew that he was dying and that I didn't have that much time left with him, that from that day forward, I was going to make every single day of my life live it to the fullest. That from start to finish, from the point of like where I wake up to like where I go to sleep, I wasn't going to take any breaks. Wrap it up here? 5 minutes? Okay. I wasn't going to take any breaks. And I did, you know. And so I started going to bed and I'd ask myself the question, doing my, you know, my meditation, everything like that. You know, do I, you know, doing my, like, my daily 10 step and everything like that, making my amends, being a good AA member, but then also asking myself, like, am I following my dreams? You know, am I really like living up to my potential? Could I be doing better for this? Because when I saw, you know, Mike and all the examples that I have before as he passed away, all they wanted to do was live longer. They had so much love in their life. And I remember when, you know, I finally got the call and they had him at home in hospice and he was dying and I was there. You know, I just remember like seeing there must have been 800 people that came in and out of his house like for that week. And I'm thinking to myself, like, what a life, you know, because no matter how I'm going to go out, this is something I have no control over either. All I can do is the best that I can. And here's this guy who has so much love in his life. And I can only hope to die with, you know, half as much dignity and love and respect from like my fellow men and women. And the way that, you know, the relationship that he had with like his wife, it's just something that I learned here too. I learned how to have relationships in this program too. And one thing that I always like, that I love to hear Mike talk about was like how much he loved his wife. He was just like, he would like take out every opportunity that he could to talk about how much he loved his wife. You know? And that's the type of guy that he was. And so this is what I aspire to be like. You know? And I remember being there and all the people coming in and he just looked at me and he said, Steve, you know, he said, I'm proud of you, of the man that you've become. He said, I never would have guessed, you know, I never would have guessed from like day one. But he said, I'm proud of the man that you've become. And he's like, you need to go back home and find a new sponsor. And I was like, I knew what that meant, you know, I knew what that meant. And it's interesting in death, because I've seen a lot of death being sober over the past, you know, over the past years. And it was almost like Mike was taking care of all of his responsibilities and cleaning up everything so he could leave peacefully, making sure that everyone was taken care of. Till the day he died, he wasn't even on his mind. It was the other people. He was worried about his wife. You know, Steve, make sure you take care of like my wife and call and everything. And I said, it's done. Absolutely. You know? And so I think about him when I'm talking about, you know, living my life to the fullest and doing everything, him and the other people that came before me, I really think about them. Looking down, Mike used to say there's two types of people in the world. The people who, the good Samaritans who bring their shopping cart back, and the fucking scumbags who don't. And I'm forever broken. I can't ever not return a shopping cart in any place that I go. And I've got this complex now where like someone won't do it, and I'm like mad dogging them, be like, you scumbag. How could you do that? Kind of a person you think you are. But what I learned from him was to just carry it on. So like I'm not sad so much anymore, because he never would have wanted me to be sad. You know, he would have just wanted me to be happy and teach the things that, you know, he taught me. And so I think about them, like, and all the people that have passed, because I've had a lot more relationships with a lot more different people who aren't here anymore. And I think about them up, looking down, making them proud. In life and death, it's important for me to make them proud, you know? And so I do that every day. And this is how I interpret the 12th step, you know? We do these actions in all of our affairs. And this isn't always necessarily in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is in my professional life, because I'm a big believer that you can't be one guy in one place and a different guy in another place. I am who I am, in Alcoholics Anonymous and in my personal life. And how I treat people is how I treat people, whether I do it here or outside there. And these are concepts that they made so true to me. You know, and when Mike finally passed away and we buried him, you know, my dad got out of jail, and then everything finally, it's funny how there's closures to things, you know, there's just closure to things. And here I am, like, coming out of it, and I'm taking my I always go up to that meeting on Wednesday to take a cake, and I'm up there like taking my 11th year last year, and I find myself for the first time, because I like to talk. And I always got something to say. This was a problem when I was newly sober. I've managed to control it a little bit better now, but I was speechless. Because for the first time, like, in my life, I was so filled with gratitude that words couldn't describe how it was that I was feeling. You know? Just overpaid was the only thing that I can think of, because this life that I have and the incredible things that I get to bear witness to just be a part of my experience, is, like I said, nothing that I would have ever imagined, you know? I could have never thought that it would ever be this good, that I would ever have it this together, that my parents would ever, like, trust me this much, that I would have this many good relationships this long of a time with, like, this many people, you know? These are just things that I didn't understand. These are all things that I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, from men like my sponsor and people just like you and meetings just like these all over the world. And what an incredible community to be a part of. And that one thing that brought us together was just the fact that, like, we couldn't control or manage our drinking. And that's what got us here. You know? And so I lay in bed at night, and I'll wrap it up with this. Thinking about this, right? Just like, just analyzing, like, how big of an idea that really is, you know? For my small mind to try to comprehend and wrap around the idea that it's just like, I can't fail here. You know? No one's getting out of this alive. And I make a choice whether I want to do that with dignity and honor and integrity and respect of my fellows, or the other way, which is the way that I was before I came in here. And this is a decision that only I can make. But as long as I stick to the agreement that I made when I first got here, and I continue to have that desire to stop in a state change, then I'm safe. And it doesn't matter what happens to me in my life. It doesn't matter what kind of crazy things I go through, whether it's sickness or loss of money or death, right? Wife or no wife, job or no job. It does not matter what I go through, because I have a design to live. And over a long enough period of time, things will get good, things will get bad again, things will get good again, and things will get bad again. And if I can just stay in the moment and live there every day and just enjoy it as much as I can and have as much fun despite what everybody else is doing, what everybody else says I should do, then what an incredible gift that is. What an absolutely incredible gift that is. And those are just some of the things that I was taught here. So, again, I want to thank you for the opportunity to get a chance to be up here and talk to my fellows. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm forever indebted to it for what it's done for my life. So, thank you very much. Have a good night.